Dear students, welcome back. This is now the session 3 of the International Relations and European Integration class. Today we will continue the preliminaries, the theoretical preliminaries of this class. And first I will introduce you to the antidote of realism to the security dilemma. There is an approach called neoliberal institutionalism, which shows that in certain situations, when actors find themselves, when states find themselves in a situation of the prisoner's dilemma, cooperation is nevertheless possible. I will then, after the first mini break, present you a very important branch of theorizing in international politics or in the social sciences in general, and this theorizing addresses the collective action dilemma. Why is cooperation so difficult when you have a multitude of actors, sometimes with diverging interests? And in the last part of today's session, I will also address a topic which is the depletion of common resources like fisheries in the worldwide oceans. And this is then based on the collective action approach that I will present in the second part. But let me now turn to the first part, and here I will briefly revisit with you the so-called security dilemma. When John Hertz formulated the security dilemma, he was addressing theorizing theories of international politics that have become popular after World War I and which reappeared after World War II. And this approach is called idealism, which is a very optimistic branch of liberal scholarship. And this approach puts hope into so-called collective security, meaning that certain international norms can be developed, certain treaties can be concluded, which make cooperation lasting. And John Hertz said this is not possible. Cooperation is not possible because states mistrust each other in international relation. No binding agreement is possible in such a situation. And the security dilemma can be nicely illustrated through the prisoner's dilemma game, which, as you know by now, ends in a situation of mutual defection, which can also mean then that states build up arms because they cannot trust the other side. Okay, so just to put this into context, we have the pessimistic worldview, which is the realist school of thought, and we have the more optimistic school of thought, which is liberalism. And to a large extent, liberal scholarship draws on political philosophers from the Enlightenment. Montesquieu, and in particular Immanuel Kant, some scholars like Bruce Russett and Seth Maus have then developed a Kantian piece which draws on Kant's essay Zum ewigen Frieden, Eternal Peace. I will come back to this particular approach later on. What is important now is idealism, as I said earlier. This is a response to World War II and has largely to do with Woodrow Wilson, who was the US president during World War I. And this president convinced Congress that the United States should become a party against Germany. And he made a declaration for which he received the support then of Congress, which is known for its shorthands, that this war should be launched in order to make the world safe for democracy. The implicit hope here is that if you have enough democratic states in the international system, then this system becomes stable in the sense that states do not resort to war. This conviction was also then influencing the 14 points with which Wilson came forward to come up with an order for the international system after the so-called Great War. And he put down here principles for a common peace. And one of them was the foundation of the League of Nations. And what is particularly important here for the League of Nations is that this global organization, the predecessor to the United Nations, should function as a global alliance. So if there is one state that goes against these collective interests, every member state of the League of Nations should punish this state. The idealist hope also found expression in the so-called Kellogg-Briand Pact, two statesmen, and this was an attempt to come up with an international treaty that eliminates war as an instrument of national policy. War is forbidden through international law. So these hopes were expressed in the Constitution or the Covenant of the League of Nations, and you see here in Article 16 how this alliance commitment should function. So if there is committed an act of war against all members of the League, then these states should together punish this particular states. And this should then go towards economic, financial interactions with these states, but it should also include other kind of sanctions, meaning a war of the other nations against these states. These hopes were quite quickly dashed by the behavior of certain member states, Japan, which invaded Manchuria, northern China, Italy, which invaded current or present day Ethiopia, and then also Adolf Hitler walked out of an international disarmament conference, and all his later behavior obviously also was against the spirit of the League of Nations. So collective security in this form did not work properly. Nevertheless, then in the UN Charter, you have the same principle enshrined, especially in Article 41. And what you have in the UN Charter is a clear trade-off, on the one hand, between the principle of the sovereign equality of all the member states, and then what you have in Article 41, that the member states, the United Nations, are nevertheless here entitled to go and work together against member states which do not behave properly, which do not act in the collective interest here. The typical actions that then the Security Council, the executive branch of the United Nations in security affairs can take involves economic sanctions. You see this here, may include complete or partial interruption of economic relation, and so on. But also in Article 42, you see here that the Security Council can decide to build a multilateral force and to wage a war against a particular state. And there are examples of such UN-mandated wars. The Korean War is one example where the UN gave the United States and its allies the power to intervene in this conflict between North Korea and South Korea. And you know the consequences that we have two nations here which are still at loggerheads with each other. Another example is the first Iraq war. Okay, so this is the principle of collective security, and John Hurt says this does not work properly. Cooperation is not possible. Here the groundwork was laid by Robert Axelrod from the University of Michigan, who said in the 1980s, through a formal analysis, cooperation is possible in a situation of the prisoner's dilemma if certain conditions exist. One of them is that this interaction is repeated over time. You do not only find yourself in a prisoner's dilemma today, but also tomorrow, in 2 days, in 10 years, in 20 years, and so on. Repetition without any end. You cannot foresee that after 1 week's time, the cooperation will end. You make your last interaction. So it's an iterated prisoner's dilemma game. The second notion that he introduced here is the so-called shadow of the future. And the shadow of the future, in his reasoning, should be large enough, meaning that future interactions weigh heavily in the minds of the decision makers. And the shadow of the future is nothing else than an inverse discount factor. So discounting simply means you have a certain cake to eat today, and for today, this cake has this size. When you can only eat it tomorrow, so the consumption tomorrow weighs less, has a lower utility for you. And it depends on how hungry you are. If you are very hungry, then the size of the future cake is much smaller. So a large, an extended shadow of the future basically means that you do not discount very heavily. So, and the chance of cooperation, that you end up in a situation of continued cooperation, grows with an increased shadow of the future. But there is a second element which is important here, and this is that you have a punishment system included here. And what matters here is then different strategies. One of them is called tit for tat, and the usage, the reliance of the states on this strategy enforces then that states cooperate, that they have an interest, a continued interest in cooperating with each other. So this is nothing else, this punishment mechanism, than some sort of enforcement of joint rules. And you see here, realists say these rules have no importance. And modern liberal scholars say there are certain rules, and it depends very much on the interaction. So what is tit for tat? Tit for tat was a strategy that was developed by Anatole Rapoport, and it largely follows the logic of the saying from the Bible, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So you start out cooperating, but if your partner defects in this particular situation, then you will punish him or her with your own defection in the next round. So what you are doing is just mimicking what your partner has done in the last move. Okay, how did he find out that tit-for-tat is a functioning strategy? What Axelrod did was the organization of a tournament, meaning he organized a competition, asked colleagues, can you propose a certain strategy that will elicit the highest collective payoff? And then different scholars took part in that. So you see here on this slide a number of proposals that were made. Anatole Rapoport came up with a very short program, and this is the tit-for-tat proposal that he introduced. And you see here that some of the alternative programs were much more refined. The computer code was much longer. On the right-hand side of the slide, you see here what Axelrod meant with the evolution of cooperation. So in this tournament, is based then on a computer simulation where the different strategies were played against each other. So you have artificial players, some of them using tit-for-tat, other ones, other strategies, and what is then evaluated by the computer is just which of these strategies works best, which of these punishment mechanisms yields the highest collective payoff. And according to this notion, it is tit for tat. Axelrod was immediately joined because this was a finding which was well published. There was an article, as you have seen, in Science, an article in Journal of Conflict Resolution. There was this influential book that Axelrod published. So he was joined by Robert Cohane, and they published together an article in which they said that, okay, this tit-for-tat is a specific mechanism that we can find in international relation, and this is reciprocity. So cooperation between states is possible if you have certain rules, if you have rules that are reciprocal and the players respect these particular rules. So there is retaliation included, but actors also know that they have a long time horizon that they cannot escape from each other. So take for instance France and Germany. They know that they have to work out specific solutions, and they will also be in the same situation tomorrow in some years. So there is an institutional aspect to this. These are these rules, and this is why this particular approach is then also coined neoliberal institutionalism. Realists believe that such institutions, such rules might exist, but when here a real conflict breaks out, these rules do not play a role. Okay, there has been a huge discussion in the literature over this particular approach, some of them looking very much on the research design of the studies by Robert Axelrod. And as any model, it is based on certain assumptions. And one of the strong assumptions here is that tit-for-tat does not allow for errors. Hmm? A certain actor, a certain player might not observe perfectly what the other side has done. Hmm? And this player might believe that in the last round the other side defected, did not cooperate, and this can then trigger off a defection chain. So this is a very strong assumption, and this might not especially work out. So in order to overcome this, and Axelrod contributed to this, you need to introduce more forgiving strategy. There were also some game theorists who have shown that tit-for-tat is not necessarily stable. It does not necessarily yield the highest payoff, so they proposed some other strategy. Perhaps the most interesting from a political science perspective qualification of the approach has come from Jim Fearon from Stanford University in an article he published in International Organization. This is an influential journal. So what Jim found is that when you're in a situation, and think about the European Union and the United Kingdom. So the Brexit situation is a very important one. So you have very, very intensive discussions, long negotiations between the two sides, especially because the shadow of the future is very long. So, if the cake is very large and you know that you have to jointly consume this particular cake for a long time, then you negotiate very hard. So, Fearon introduced a model which reflects the international situation much better, which is not as simplistic. States negotiate over the rules that they find for their particular interactions. If the collective interest is not that important, then they can easily agree on certain rules. The negotiations do not last that long. Okay, so this was the first theory of cooperation, and the theory of cooperation that was especially developed to counter the pessimism of classic realism, of the proponents of the view that in international politics a security dilemma prevents states from cooperating. Okay. I have here two questions. Think about those. You can also discuss them in the tutorials. Thank you. Welcome back. This is the second part of session 3, and we are dealing today with theories of cooperation. And here I will present a theory which addresses the collective action problem. Why, under certain conditions, cooperation among many actors is particularly difficult. Okay, and this approach allows you to address the problems of cooperation, for instance, in international environmental affairs, but also in international security. So think about sanctions that are levied against particular states. These situations are more generally quite often called social dilemma. So this is, for instance, has to do with fishing. As you know, certain species, fish and so on, are threatened to become extinct, and this has to do with the over consumption of these particular species. This has to do with hunting. So you see here certain pictures, so about Buffalo Bill, whom you might have known as a hero, but when you know that he has killed and more 4,000 bison, then he's no longer so much as a hero. What these hunters engage in is Nash behavior. They follow their own interests. And when all the actors follow their own interests, then you might end up in a situation that is not in the collective interest. Okay, and you see here this particular social dilemma here with regard to bluefin tuna. The more actors are engaged in this, build vessels to catch a particular fish, the less fish they bring home in the end, because the catches become more smaller over time. And then the prices for this particular good for bluefin tuna fish go up as a consequence. So the approaches that I will present help you to understand the social and political dynamics behind it, but also more positively, possible solutions to this. Okay, the groundbreaking contribution to the understanding of so-called collective action problems, of solutions to social dilemmas, is by Manker Olson. He was a student at Harvard University in economics. His advisor was Paul Samuelson, and Paul Samuelson had worked on the theory of public goods. And Manker Olson used then this typology to develop his theory of collective action. So, what is a public good? A public good has two characteristics. So, on the one hand, it's non-rival. Everyone can consume it at the same time. So, take a lecture hall, everyone can listen to the lecture simultaneously, the fresh air that you breathe, hopefully the windows are open, can be consumed by anyone. Simultaneously, this also means that you cannot exclude anyone from the consumption of such a good. Okay, you have now so-called impure public goods if one of these conditions is not met. One of these types are common pool goods. And here you can think about what is called in German the Allmende. You can also think about highways during rush hour. Highways have been financed by taxpayer. So in an ideal situation, everyone can consume it, but if more and more cars are on the same highway, the consumption of free traffic becomes rival and you are stuck. So this is one impure public good, the common pool good, where the consumption of this good is rival. The second criteria that can be used by the members of the certain or the, by a certain group of actors, which is also called a club, is that they can exclude other actors from consuming this particular good. So think, for instance, about golf club or yacht club. You have to pay a membership fee. You have to own a yacht to become a member of such a club. And not everyone can afford to become a member of such a club. Trivially, if both of these conditions are not met, then you have a private good. And the private good can be an ice cone, it can be a bottle of water that you have bought in a particular store. You can exclude other actors from consuming it, and in certain conditions, fresh water is obviously a rival good. Okay, so what you should think about now, since I have taken examples to illustrate this from daily life, are political equivalents. What is, for instance, a pure public good in politics? What is a club good? What is a common pool good? And there is this nice saying which you can use with regard to specific political clubs, like take for instance NATO or the European Union by Groucho Marx, from the Marx Brothers, a comedian of the 1930s and subsequent decades. I refuse to join any club that would have me as a member. So what are such examples? For pure public good, it is security. So take, for instance, NATO, a military alliance. It provides security to its members, but not exclusively to its members. Neighboring states can also profit from the security that is provided through this international alliance. A common pool good, as I've mentioned beforehand, are, for instance, fisheries. Here you have different fleets of different states, and they try to maximize their catch, but the more ships you have here, the more fishermen you have who are trying to catch a particular fish, the smaller each catch gets. So it's an overusage of this particular good. And for the club good, you can take again NATO, because there are certain membership conditions, but you can also take the European Union. Here, certain members can be, or certain states can be, excluded from the benefits that arise out of this cooperation. So, and when you think about the Brexit negotiations, the conservative British government does not want to pay the membership fees, at least. This is what the negotiators of the EU perceive them doing, and they describe this negotiation strategy as such. You can also think about, for the EU, the membership conditions here are that states have the joint legislation, they have the joint rules, they have to transpose these law, these collective laws, these collective regulations into national laws. So this is the membership price, a certain loss of sovereignty that has to be paid in order to profit from this particular good, which is the internal market of the European Union. Why is now the provision of public goods, why is this now difficult? What Manker Olsen did, he identified certain regularities. And one of the regularities is that you have an exploitation of the large members through the small members. And the typical, or one of the first examples that has been used here, was based on a study by Manker Olsen and Richard Zeckhauser, where they looked at defense budgets And you see here in the fourth column, defense budget as a percentage of GNP, the gross national product, that larger states in this period, the United States, Germany, United Kingdom, France, and Italy, they contributed, relatively speaking, much more to security than smaller members. Why is this the case? Think about here Luxembourg. Luxembourg obviously could completely abolish to pay anything for defense, for security, simply because it would profit from what the other sides are, the other member states of NATO are doing. Okay, so this is one of the hypotheses, which is the free riding hypothesis. And the logic of this has been nicely illustrated by Todd Sandler. Todd Sandler is the main author in this area. He has taken up the approach by Menker, Olson, and made many important contributions, both theoretical but also empirical. So what you have here is just an illustration. So you have here five actors, and each of them can decide on whether or not contributing to a joint activity or not. And the incentive structure favors here free riding. So you see this here, the benefits of contributing to the public good is five. This is the payoff, and the costs of doing so is minus eight. So if no one, and this you see in the second column through the zero on top, if no one contributes to the public good, then you lose as actor I minus three unit. And this difference always remains. So if you have one state contributing here to this joint activity, you have a higher payoff for not contributing than for contributing by your own, because you have to pay for this particular activity. And the more actors contribute, the better it is for the free rider. But you see here, the Nash equilibrium is zero. So you observe this, and you observe this especially if the actors are heterogeneous. So the free riding thesis means that these actors differ in size, and what you then have is at least an underprovision of a public good, which in this case, or in many applications, is security. Okay, so this is Menker Olson. He developed this free riding hypothesis together with some other hypothesis in his doctoral dissertation, which he then published in the mid 1960s in a book with the title The Logic of Collective Action. And he has done many more interesting contributions over the continuing decades. So he analyzed also why certain states grow more quickly than other ones. And he made also in a posthumous contributions, Power and Prosperity, a contribution to our understanding on of whether or not democracies or autocracies are economically more successful. So let's move to his hypothesis. The first hypothesis is that one can distinguish between small groups of actors and large group of actors. So certain interests are privileged because they benefit a smaller group. And these smaller groups have an advantage in organizing themselves publicly. Mm? So think about the division of interests between consumers on the one hand and then industrial lobbies. Take, for instance, the agricultural sector. In developed industrial nations, you have very few farmers. They have not such high costs of organizing themselves, so they are privileged. Consumers are all of us, and we have big difficulties in coming up with a joint action. So in a typical society, you would have an over representation here of privileged or special interests in comparison to public interest. The second hypothesis is the free riding hypothesis that I already introduced. And the third one, this is based on his book of the 1960s, is just what kind of mechanisms exist there to overcome these particular problems of collective actions. And what he proposed are two mechanisms. One is called selective incentives, and the second one are institutions. Okay, so you can introduce certain rules, you can give subsidies to specific interests in society so that they can organize themselves. A second solution is if you privatize certain rules, if the contribution to public good is also driven by a private interests of these members. So think as an example, for instance, about student activities at the university. Students' interests are not that well represented in the university because there are many more students than professors. What are the selective incentives for students to become politically engaged? So they can build their own political career based on that. They can participate in meetings. So there is a private interest component to this, and this has been called selective incentives by Menker Olsen. Okay, I have also two hypotheses that he developed in later research. One of them refers to the difference in economic success of different states. So he believed that over time, special interests in a society become stronger and stronger, and he explains then the fate of post-World War II societies over time. And I will briefly say something about the distinction between autocracies and democracies. Okay, so what you have here is just to explain why here public goods are underprovided. Some people believe that Olsen said that public goods are not provided at all if you do not have then selective incentives or particular institutions. This is wrong. What he says is that just the more actors you have in a society, the smaller is the individual contribution. And if the group is very large, the latent interests are very concern many different individuals, then some of them might not have an interest to contribute at all, and then they free ride completely on the others. So think here about the costs and benefit of an action. From an individual perspective, the optimal contribution is where the marginal benefits correspond to the marginal costs. So this is then shown here through the point S. If you have then a second actor contributing here, then you see here that you have then a second contribution, which is S prime. And here this contribution, so this is the difference between O and S, and S and S prime respectively, becomes smaller and smaller. And this can be easily illustrated through this decision theoretic diagram here. And then you can sum up all of the contributions in this stylized illustration of the principle why you have an under-provision of public goods. Okay. I've already said that you have certain groups that are overrepresented in the political process, and this is what is called special interests, which have powerful lobbies out there. And one typical example is the agricultural industry, but you can also think about the chemical industry. At certain periods of time, the banking industry was very important. Think about the German automobile sector and the corona measures in comparison to the financial crisis 10 years earlier. Then the automobile sector was very privileged. It puts its interests through. Apparently, it has lost some of its political clout over time when you think about the measures that were taken as a response to the coronavirus crisis. Okay, so this is the theory of collective actions. I will come back to this after this mini break in the certain last part of this session. Thank you, and think about this particular question. Welcome, this is the last part of session 3 of the International Relations and European Integration lecture. What I will do now is just to continue with some of the key hypotheses that can be derived from Menker-Olsen's work, and then I will deal with the common pool resources that I have already presented and also some approaches that have been developed to overcome the problems in providing here solution to this particular dilemma. Okay, let's first move to Menker-Olsen and the hypothesis that he developed to explain why Germany and Japan grew more quickly after World War II than, for instance, the UK. So you see here how in the beginning of the post-World War II era, Japan and Germany especially were catching up with the Anglo-Saxon world. Olsen published in the 1980s this book about the rise and decline of nations, and his key argument is that in the Anglo-Saxon world, in the world that was winning World War II, you have especially powerful distributional coalitions. So these are the special interests, and these special interests gain more time, gain more power over time. So this leads then to this asymmetry, and over time this asymmetry gets worse and worse between here then general or public interests and this special interests. And why is this the case? Because these distributional coalitions, you have, for instance, a certain monopoly in a country, so producers which benefit from a high price, this high price they get out of protection from the state. And what they do is they invest a lot of money in keeping this privileged position. So they do not have then an interest in investing in productive capacity. They just want to keep the situation as it is. And this leads, according to Menke Olsen, then to a sclerotic development in society. Okay, so this was his contribution of the 1980s, and this is also important from an international relations perspective, because one observes something similar, which is called the Phoenix factor. And this is an observation that has been attributed to the situation of the United States after the Civil War of the 1860s, that after this period, the South grew more quickly than the North. So the losing side was also here growing then more quickly, and this is sometimes then often a paradox why this is the case. And Olsen provided here a specific explanation. Okay, Olsen made, and this is his last main contribution, also he contributed to the research that tries to explain why certain countries grow more quickly. This is important for studies of development. How can you enhance economic growth in certain countries? And he believed that political institutions are very important here. And one can have different types of autocrats. And it's important whether here you are a stationary bandit or whether you are a roving bandit. And for a roving bandit, you can think about a powerful actor, like a criminal actor, or in medieval times, you have some knight on a castle, and occasionally this knight comes down and robs the entire population, all the farmers, of what they have earned over time. Simultaneously, such actors have an interest in controlling the territory. They might then become what Olsen calls stationary bandits. And here you have different types, the ones who encourage property and contract rights, and this induces economic growth, or you then try just to control the institutions, but do not build institutions and rules that lead to economic growth. The typical problem that you have in all these autocracies is that there is no succession procedure. You had this partly with royal, that the firstborn, most often the son, becomes then the future monarch. But under communist regimes, with the exception of North Korea, for instance, you do not have a clear succession procedure. This leads to infighting. And autocrats in such regimes are always threatened. This is also the case when you think about monarchs. So, for instance, in Russia, in Tsarist Russia, there were often different tsars who claimed to be the real rulers and the legitimized rulers, but this is not then something which is unique to this particular time. You can also think about current Belarus, current Russia, what will happen with Putin. So these leaders are always threatened, and if this threat that they might be moved out of office, that they might be killed in a coup d'etat, shortens then their time horizon, and this leads to a plundering of the economy of their countries. And economically speaking, the worst kind of autocrats are kleptocrats. There are many examples out there. Many of them has obviously bank accounts in dubious countries in this respect, Switzerland, Cayman Islands, and so on. And they also show off with their riches. One particular example is the widow of Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, who invested a lot of the money then in a shoe collection, several thousand of shoes, and at a certain point of time there was then also a museum when this Marcos family was forced to flee the country. Here you see an old list of how much certain autocrats were plundering their economies. Ferdinand Marcos is here on the second rank. In neighboring Indonesia, you have an even greedier autocrat, the Suharto family. And this is especially interesting when you compare the money that they have organized, stolen for their own families in comparison to the GDP per capita. So this kind of behavior, according to Menker, Olsen, then the short time horizon, the lack of a succession rule leads to this plundering of these particular economies and leads to underdevelopment. But let's move back to the theory of collective action and the problem that one has with the provision or finding a solution to common pool situations. This was aptly described in a short article by Garrett Hardin, which he entitled The Tragedy of the Commons, and which was published in 1968 in Science. And he described this as a situation where you have a pasture open to all, and this gives an incentive for every herdsman. If you do not have any institution to bring his or her cattle to this particular pasture. And over time, all the grass is eaten off by the cattle. I already used the example of the tuna catches and how this has gone down over time. This is simply because many more fishermen have gone on the seas and tried to catch bluefin tuna and other kind of fish for which a high price the markets offer. Okay, so fisheries are not the only global commons. There are many different other kinds of fisheries. Think about biodiversity. Think about the polar regions. Think about the internet or outer space. These are all global commons, and there are no clear rules in how to use them. Obviously, the internet is a kind of commons good that can be debated, because what you observe nowadays are increasing attempts by states to regulate the internet and to restrict or at least regulate the access of citizens to the internet and its different services. Okay, so global commons create specific problems of cooperation. Okay, and this is very similar in the analysis as the contribution game that we have beforehand. That I also take here an example out of the very nice article by Todd Sandler, Collective Action 50 Years Later. And so here, for instance, is the situation that you have a pasture and farmers have an incentive to cattle graze there. When your cattle graze, you receive a payoff of 8 and you have costs of 5. And here the situation is just the reverse what you have from the contribution game, because you have rivalry. So the more farmers put their cattle on this pasture, the smaller or the larger the disutility for the society is. And again, this is the Nash equilibrium that you find here when all these different actors then send their cattle here. And this you see in the lower right situation here with a Nash payoff of minus 17. But this is individual rational. So you still have an incentive to send your cattle there, although this is socially very detrimental. So the question exists, can we find solutions to this particular problem? And there are some people who have come up with solution, and the most prominent is the late Elinor Ostrom, a political scientist from the United States, who died 8 years ago and who received the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2009. She was the first woman who received the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences. And some of my colleagues in economics were then quite distressed that the political scientist would receive this prize and asked me, and who is this particular lady? The irony was that she was not allowed to enter a doctoral program in economics at the time when she was studying. So she chose then political science and was very successful. So what Elinor Ostrom proposed, and this is very similar and draws on the contribution of Bob Axelrod, was institutions, rules that are able to manage access to these common pool resources. And this she has described in different articles and entire books. So what you have here are certain principle that she has defined. So what is especially needed here are clearly defined rules, which actors are entitled to consume this particular good. So property rights have to be taken into account. Global solutions, this is the second principle, is something which might not work here. So the specific local situation has to be taken into account. The parties which are entitled, which receive rights, property rights as such, they should also take part in collective decision making. So what you have here is then some sort of direct democracy. Obviously, when you limit, for instance, the access to the pasture for a certain period of time, you need a system of monitoring. As you need in the iterated prisoner's dilemma, you have to observe their how the other parties behaved, and this is called monitoring. So you need an effective monitoring system, and if you have certain actors who are cheating, then you need some sort of sanctioning mechanism, but also conflict resolution mechanisms. Okay, the obvious question that one can pose here is obviously, do such institutions, do such mechanisms work for larger common pool resources? Think about the fisheries. There is an EU fisheries policies, which basically then privatizes here access of the different member states. So they receive certain quotas for certain fish. This is one solution here, but when you think about global fisheries, obviously this is something much more difficult to regulate. So some people say this is fine with local problems, but obviously you can also say that the world consists of many, many different local problems. So it's better sometimes also to think about such low-key decision-making processes. Okay. So, and what you should think about here, whether this particular approach might be successful. What are the underlying conditions, the underlying assumptions here? And then you think also about the global commons that are particularly hard to regulate. Okay, thank you for listening to this particular session. And we will hopefully see each other quite soon again.